poetry. What is it? It is like a crumpled white rose, but very different. I went hunting for it. So I took the hens and talked to them till they were in a good humor. It isn't the first time I've had four parts of a mind. Good morning, shoot me, because I am a pernicious example of searching. It is mad like a plowed field. It is the clack of tongues and scooped out pumpkins and a great stone and the wind saying something about bread. Anonymous made music for all coming generations of English-speaking people. Think of him as a prima donna, some splendid Italian or noble Swede. He knew that he himself was a musical nobody. He knew pretty well and chuckled inwardly like the scarlet lark when she sinks into her nest at sunset. Thank you, song. Now run along. Mean again, nothing often. I hear the wind carrying strawberries. Some of the people up there must like them. It is a little lamb with no father nor mother in the world, so she set to eat sunbonnets. It is like a crippled saint keeping a small private heaven. What should we do with it? Go and get it this minute, this living minute. So I ran, dripping, looking like a maniac, as if I was the shadow of a great awe, struck by lightning, shattered into kindling wood. It goes from flower to flower like butterflies with nostrils distended. The words come out of the houses to listen. No one else could have heard it but a fox in Russia 6 years ago. I swan, it said, wanting to try all kinds of nonsense. Mind hearing. That's the name for it. Sunset took out needle and thread and mended it. I love it well and wish I might hear it occasionally instead of the odious tortures. As if holding silent commune with Trixie, it just flew. Look critically at imaginary dust. This is a pleasure, pronounced art. Your voice here. Your tender heart, taken with a cramp, almost drowned, but didn't know how. There was black lightning in instant sympathy. Several houses have been entered and robbed of tea with the moon full on it. Twisted mountain brook, you're going to be a tall woman. A note of invitation floated out on the evening air, filling the whole world, and people came softly out on tiptoe and sat down beside the road to listen and curled themselves up on the grass. Poetry, how heavy it had grown since last he held it. And now his name, beloved instrument of breath shrieks. The plot, jagged, formless, rough, long and yet sparse, speculated on the probable spiritual whereabouts of old letters. Everyone was the last person buried in it. Words. I wonder who wrote you, and if you like to be alive, and were sorry to be used by time, because you were gentle and shy. I think we are related, like butterflies in an hourglass. Reading quietly beside a small white stone, the squirrel cried at the end. Books could have been happier, Miss Vesta thought, if she had had three pairs of eyes. Wrong words, 1,000 a year, 1,000 a year. After a tiresome day, take 75 bottles of Vegetin, pound up the 75 bottles with their labels, and take those with some pills. Knitting the house, which at first had no meaning. Time times time is time. Like all the angels in heaven, a penknife, a canary bird, and 50 cents. That's what it carried. Feeling high, the autumn leaves relaxed, dropped gently, fell asleep, and slept. I am well, thank you, answered the soul, sitting there in the dark. Moistened words. God, as Auntie Joy had always described him. The white lilacs fill the whole world with my bones. Spread on the grass to bleach. A drawing of purple shadows, always some baptism. The charred, the blind, the unmoved, the never forgiven, the purely thankful, the dreadful, the crusty, that man with the operation. The head has come back to us, softer than people remember it. Noodles turning round to make sure that it is all true. It is a nest, yes, but what is poetry? And that was an erasure, and I passed some pages around so you could figure out what that was, and it's a major part of my life, and I just wanted to share it with you before I began. So now I want to read an essay, a little essay. It's called Observations on the Ground. We can't turn this off, right? Because it's just what it is. Ah, right. Don't ask me to choose because everyone would hate me. Observations on the Ground. This is written in prose, has a right, my definition of prose is right flush margin. It's as simple as that. Don't waste hours talking about it. The planet seen from extremely close up is called the ground. The ground can be made loose by the human hand or by using a small tool held in the human hand, such as a spade, or an even larger tool, such as a shovel, or a variety of machines commonly called heavy equipment. We bury our dead in the ground. Roughly half of the dead are buried in boxes, and half of the dead are buried without boxes. A burying box is an emblem of respect for the dead. We are the only species to so envelop our dead. An earlier, more minimal way to envelop the dead was to wrap them in cloth. Besides burying the dead in the ground, we bury our garbage, also called trash. Man-made mountains of garbage are pushed together using heavy equipment and then pushed down into the ground. The site of this burial is called a landfill. The site of the dead buried in boxes is called a cemetery. In both cases, the ground is being filled. A dead body in a box can be lowered into the ground using heavy equipment, but we do not consider it trash. When the dead are not in boxes and there is a man-made mountain of them, we use heavy equipment to bury them together, like trash. It is estimated that everywhere we walk, we are walking on a piece of trash and the hard, insoluble remains of the dead. Whatever the case, the dead and the garbage are together in the ground where we cannot see them, for we do not relish the sight or smell of them. If we did not go about our burying, we would be in danger of being overcome. Also buried in the ground are seeds, which we want to see when they emerge from the ground in their later form, that is, as plants. Plants rising from the ground are essential to life. To bury a seed is to plant it. When a seed is planted and not seen again, those who buried it are made sad. The anticipated plant of the wished upon seed has not materialized. It is dead and remains buried. Heavy equipment is used to plant large expanses of ground with seed. When a whole field of shivering grain rises from the earth, there is a growing sense of happiness among those who buried it. Happiness is also present when a tree emerges, or a tree that will bear fruit, or leafy green edible plants that were formerly planted. When flowers arise from the ground, colorful and shapely in an astonishing variety of ways, the living are made especially happy. Not only are flowers admired for their outward form of beauty of form, their scents are capable of overcoming us and therefore prized. Nothing, it seems, makes the living as happy as a flower. Flowers are among the most anticipated things on earth. For this reason, we separate the flower from the ground and present it to another to hold or to look at. After a while, the flower which has been separated from the ground dies, and we throw it in the trash. Flowers are often planted where the dead are buried in boxes, but these flowers are never cut. That would be horrible. Whoever did such a thing would be considered a thief. Those flowers belong to the dead. Saga. Everything that ever happened to me is just hanging, crushed and sparkling in the air, waiting to happen to you. Everything that ever happened to me happened to somebody else first. I would give you an example, but they are all invisible, or off gallivanting around the globe. Not here when I need them, now that I need them, if I ever did, which I doubt. Being particular has its problems. In particular, there is a rift through everything. There is a rift running the length of Iceland, and so a rift runs through every family and between families of feud. It's called a saga. Rifts and sagas fill the air, and beautiful old women sing of them. So the air is filled with music and the smell of berries and apples and shouting when a gun goes off and crying in closed rooms. faces, who needs them? Eating the blood of oranges, I in my alcove could use one. Abbas and Ammas, come out of your huts, travel halfway around the world, inspect my secret bank account of joy. My face is a jar of honey you can look through. You can see everything is muted, so terribly muted. Who could ever speak of it, sealed and held up for all? I took the train to New York this morning. It's been a while since I've been on a train. I'm going to read this poem. It's one of my earliest memories. It's about being on a train with my mother. I think I was around 4. It's called En Route. On the train with my mother, as soon as it got dark, she turned the light on, and I could see myself perfectly in the dark glass, and I was startled, as I had not much experience in looking. I noticed my mother barely glanced at herself, and I got the feeling down pat people didn't have to look, or maybe they didn't want to. The lady in front of us had a fur over her shoulder, a little fox with a head and a tail and 2 glass beads embedded where its eyes would have been. It seemed to comfort her. I thought it was her pet, as I was my mother's. Then the glass eyes of the animal, fashionable pelt of the day, met mine, and I heard us speaking. When my mother reached up and turned off the light, and I saw the dark hills and the bare trees and the tiny innumerable lights of tiny innumerable towns while eating a sandwich without a single scrap of damp lettuce at the bottom, which, had it been there, I would have offered to the animal or thrown out the window. Open letter to my ancestors. Sometimes I walk around the house wearing a green clay mask. It's supposed to be for my skin, but I don't care about that. I wear it in honor of you. I am so sadly far away from you. I secretly hope someone rings the doorbell so they cannot recognize me. Surprise! I am seasick on my long voyage. I've left everything behind except this valise, which I protect with my body and God's love, because I believe in the day I will board a bus with a bag of potatoes in my right hand worth more than the valise and everything in it. Thank you for that. These smoked chops are incredible. You have to look at it as one person with a very long life. It's better that way. Blood, tears, violence, hate, ashes, everything. The mad blue terror of dying, of having to learn another language, perdurabo. It all works out in time. There is no end. I had no kids. There's a niece in Cincinnati. She's marrying a Greek next week. Just so you know, I'm going to wash you off now into the luminous depths where even a recluse bird must fly. Spider. The spider can barely walk. His legs are so scared. He's got to get from the bar of soap to the uppermost shower stall tile that is his home. And he has suffered a betrayal so great, he is lost in his own neighborhood, crawling on his hands and knees, so to speak. In and out of the shadows of other tiles he's passed before but barely recognizes, given his state of shock and disbelief. Spiders don't hear very well. He can't hear the rain as it falls and cools his flaming legs. The distant screams of another's crisis mean nothing to him. He can't hear his own heartbeat, an alarm casting his skeleton straight into hell, his blood ignited by the bellows of loss. If the gods implore him to hold his saliva, he doesn't hear them. He goes on crawling toward the one safe spot, which has become, in his mind, the destination of his life, and this night rolled into one, a wet bag at the bottom of which, were it to fall, would lie his demise, too awful to discuss. And this poem has as its title a French phrase, which I cannot pronounce, so I'll fake it. It's the French for lily of the valley, Maguette du Bois. I was an unopened action figure hidden inside an egg, inside an ovary. The next thing I knew, I was on the couch reading Madame Bovary. And when I finished, I could not move. I took to bed with Anna Karenina and a great loom of sadness on top of me. What is human and what is life? A 5,000-page book on some small wildflower about to unfurl. This next poem is called White Buttons, and it is interrupted parenthetically by letters, like the kind you write and seal in an envelope. So I'll do my best in reading it to indicate that. Having been blown away by a book, I am in the gutter, at the end of the street, in little pieces like the alphabet. Mother, do not worry. Letters are not flesh, though there's meaning in them, but not when they are mean. My letters to you were mean. I found them after you died and read them and tore them up and fed them to the wind. Thank you for intruding. I love you. Now leave. Also at the end of the street, there is a magnolia tree, the white kind that tatters after it blooms, so the tree winds up in the street. Our naked, shivering bodies must be at some distance, missing us. Come back, they cry. Come home, put down that book. Whenever you read, you drift away on a raft. You like your parrot more than you like me, and stuff like that. Dear Father, you always were a bore, but I loved you more than interesting things. And in your honor, I felt the same about myself and everyone I've ever met. I like to read in tree houses whenever I can, which is seldom and sometimes never. The book that blew me away held all the problems of the world and those of being alive under my nose, but I felt far away from them at the same time. Reading is like that. I am sorry I did not go to your funeral, but like you said on the phone, an insect cannot crawl to China. Here at the end of the street, the insects go on living under the dome of the Pacific sky. If Mary and Joseph had walked the 60 miles to Bethlehem vertically, they would have found themselves floating in the outer pitch of space. It would have been cold. No inns, a long night in the dark endless. And when they began to cry, the whole world would think something had just been born. I like to read into things, as I am continually borne forward in time by the winds like the snow. Dear sister, you were perfect in every way, like a baby. Please tell brother, the only reason we never spoke was out of our great love for each other, which made a big wind that blew us apart. I think I am coming back. I feel shoulders where a parrot could land, though a tree would be as good a place as any. You cannot teach a tree to talk. Trees can say, it is spring, but not, though bright sunlight can also be very sad, have you noticed? (Clears throat) And this is called Mueller Me. Many of these poems, I was asked to read new works, so I've only read like two of these pieces before in public. I've never read this one. It's called Mueller and Me. It's Mueller is Wilhelm Mueller. He's a 19th century German poet who Schubert set his poems to music, the famous Miller cycle, whatever. And I quote from Mueller without acknowledging it in the poem because I figured, you know, a lot of contemporary American poets, I just don't think they sit around listening to the Schubert song cycles, and they should. And so I just thought it was a way of sharing stuff. It's not just a few lines, but Mueller and Me. I am an ordinary fauna, one who can't remember if a fife is a rifle or a flute. After all, there's strife and fight in it, but on the other hand, it's a short, sweet word that rhymes with life. The way the cemetery looks made of books, and the library is a graveyard. When love frees itself from pain, the angels cut off their wings and throw them down to earth. Throw in your scarf to cover my eyes so your shadow won't wake me. I'd like to teach a young starling to speak, but clearly and distinctly, so his words wouldn't be like human ones. I really believe my pain was not that small, but how heavy is my happiness that no sound on earth can encompass it? I'm on a fifer's ride. My steed is black and steady. I say good night to everyone. To everyone, good morn. Fireworks. The world was designed and built to overwhelm and astonish, which makes it hard to like. Like an American is someone who thinks Jan Vermeer is from Vermont and a woman. I am a woman from Vermont. Little less surprising than the copiousness of transpiration, which is so inconsequential, I cannot live without it. Later, I will look for a nail paring on the floor, as if a maid were coming tomorrow. One always has to pick up fast. Right now, I am writing on the back of a bank statement. My happiness is marred only by my failure to attain it. Otherwise, it would astonish and overwhelm. Quick, children, put on your robes. We must all go downstairs to see something. On this same night was Balthazar murdered by his servants. What the Russian soldier quoting Heine scratched on the wall in the room where the whole royal family was shot. Shot to fleshy pieces with many aims, at least 20 of which left explosive stars in the wallpaper. Their greed and power astonished all. Their death overwhelms us. Sawdust. Long before Mickey Mouse, long before his creators added gloves so his hands wouldn't terrify us, long before today's afternoon, when I was trying to take a nail out of the wall and it wouldn't stop coming, so I screamed, "How much more of you can there be?" Jesus was a kid playing with a bent nail in his father's shop when a small amount of fascinating blood started coming out of his thumb. So he turned to his dog, a puppy really, and offered the thumb to be licked without a word from anyone. Just like that. Not one adult around to start screaming. Picking up pine cones. I light a few candles so the moon is no longer alone. My secret heart wakes inside its draped cage and cracks a song. After a life of imagining, I notice the ceiling. It is painted blue with a border of pine cones. I've spent my life in a forest, picking up new things. Will it never end? I'm going to close. Now comes the good part, when I read something by somebody else. Those were poems. And I'm going to close. I'm going a little over time, but I really have to do this. I always read something by someone else. And this year, I'm reading a letter my great aunt wrote. And I'll close with this. And I don't know that much about her. I will give you just a tiny bit of backstory, but I think it's all explained. Cursive handwriting is being phased out from human existence. It is being phased out from being taught in American public schools all over this country. And every day I wake up, it breaks my heart. I'm more interested in handwriting than poems right now in my life. I'm interested in scrawled notes. I'm interested in recipes. I'm interested in letters, the private kind that have to be sealed in envelopes. I'm interested in anything that involves cursive handwriting. My great aunt was not a literary person at all, but writing kept her alive. And the blank page beckoned to her. In a way, it beckoned to thousands of lonely people in former days. She never married. She never had children. She lived in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She worked for the Sower Singing Company. She held a job for 40, 45, 50 years. She worked through the Depression. She had enough money to buy a house, but she never would. She always had tenants upstairs. And this woman, who had no children of her own, took her savings and sent two nephews to college and paid their college education. One of them was my father. That's an extraordinary thing for a single working woman to do. Unfortunately, my father dropped out of school and never graduated. I don't know how she felt about that because of the war. He joined the war effort. But anyway, I'm going to read a letter that she wrote in homage to that, to a whole generation of whatever. But she's writing my parents. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, January 6th, 1978. Dear folks, well, I had my dinner, saw this pad on table, so decided to go visit you folks. I'm still feeling okay. No pains or aches, but a bad memory. Can't understand why my memory gets bad, but I just have to live with it and be glad I can take care of myself. Of course, this bad weather, I still stay indoors, would be afraid to venture out, not even up to church. I sure get down, no calls, no visitors, so we'll just have to make best of things. I still am enjoying my meals. I get Meals on Wheels at noon, then enough left over for my dinner, so no one's troubled with getting my meals. But all day, I am alone. No calls, no letters, so there's really nothing that can be done. All I can do is just sit here and wait for the good Lord to come and take me home. Now, with the snow, no one bothers to come visit me. In fact, they don't even bother to call me. Of course, that's not only me. There sits Stella all alone, and what are all her children doing for her? I get Meals on Wheels, enough left over for my dinner. Just finished eating, dishes washed, so we'll watch TV and go to bed early. It sure is a problem to figure out why old folks are left to shift for themselves. Someday those young folks will experience the same thing. I have pain in my legs, so we'll go to bed early. I sure am glad I still can write my letters. It sure fills my time. My leg sure does pain me, but what can I do? Go to bed and sleep, then you don't feel the pain. Seems to me I did just write to you folks, but I will mail this letter anyway. I get a thrill sitting writing a letter, so we'll just keep it up. We have a little snow out, of course. I will stay indoors so it can snow all it wants to. Not too keen with my new tenant, so I have to shift for myself. Bet you folks get tired with all my letters, but I have to do something. It is just 6:30, so I have a while to go before I go to bed. I don't like to turn in before 9 o'clock. Good thing I can still write my letters. So please don't get tired of getting them. I have no neighbors to call in. There sits the lady next door at corner. She's all alone, had 12 children. Raymond was the youngest. He was buried last week. So there she sits, all alone. Day in and day out. I enjoy writing my letters so much. It's just like talking with my own party. Bet our gas bills will be big, but what can you do but pay them? I must try to get myself interested in my sewing. I ran out of material, so I'll just keep writing my letters. As far as I can see, they're not too bad for an old lady of 93. Strange how old folks are forgotten. There are the phones, but still no calls. Oh, well, one of these days they too will get old and experience the same thing. Best wishes to you all. Love, Aunt Meal. And then she keeps writing. 11 o'clock. Just looked out. Is it ever snowing? Glad I don't have to go out, but no one comes here either. Glad I get my meals brought every day at noon, so I'm no bother to any one of them. I see it is 11 a.m. next day. Meals will be here soon. I will leave my envelope open so I can write more if I want to. Well, my Meals on Wheels just came, so I better eat while it's still hot. They bring enough for my supper, so I don't have to cook, and the girls don't have to bring me anything. I just ate. I really enjoy my meals, and it's just wonderful. I don't have to cook when they come at 12 o'clock. The meals are nice and hot. Sure is wonderful setup for us old folks. We really have a nice pile of snow out there, and it sure looks like winter. Of course, I don't venture out. All I do is look out at the snow. My memories of the days we had to walk over to Bloomfield to school. We enjoyed walking those days, but now it's such a job just to walk up Dearborn to church. If this keeps up, we sure will have a nice pile of snow. I would be lost if I could not write my letters. So long as I'm able to write, I will be okay. I have a new tenant upstairs, but it's a couple. It's no good for me. Here I sit alone, no phone calls. It sure gets lonesome sitting here looking at the four walls, but what can I do? All of the club girls have passed on, so here I sit. Glad I can still write a letter. It helps my memory. It's still snowing. If it keeps up, there sure will be a pile. This is like the old-fashioned winters we used to have, and at that time we walked over to Bloomfield to school. The younger ones now have it made. I'm still feeling okay, except for the memory. It sure is bad, but I just have to live with it. I don't sew anymore, but I still try to write my letters. How are you and the family? I have a new tenant. It's a couple. They're not good for me. I just have to get along with whatever they say. Now, drop me a line when you have the time.
Thank you.
Now, Alice and I are going to talk a little bit, but I do want to say to those of you who are students and younger, if you have grandparents or great-grandparents, You just might want to drop him a line.
I didn't catch up with Mary Ruffel until this little book, A Little White Shadow. And this came out in 2006. And I loved it, and I took lasting pleasure in it, but I still didn't really discover Mary Ruffel. And I've been saying to my young colleagues at the PSA, how long have you known about Mary Ruffel? You know, almost accusingly. We've been quoting to each other back and forth from this fantastic book of her talks at Vermont College. And the PSA is giving you a great gift because this book is on sale tonight for $20, down from $25, and the selected poems are $10, down from $16. And this collected lectures is like a favorite commonplace book full of glorious quotation but it's embedded in another book, say somebody like me has put together of my favorite quotations from her essays, because they're just so wonderful, and they're full of I'll read just a couple of things that I love. A poet may know that the most eloquent word is a stone, but he must never say that, or the silence would be broken, a silence he keeps by speaking. I mean, it's just full of these kind of wonderful gnomic gems, like Antonia Portia, translated by Merwin.
Oh, yeah, I love
her. And she has a wonderful essay on the first and last lines of poems. And my predecessor at The New Yorker, Howard Moss, had written a really good essay that was published in the Kenyon Review called The First Line. He also thought that, of course, if you read a lot of poems every day, that's very important, whether you're hooked by that first line. But anyhow, your essay is just wonderful. It's called On Beginnings. You might say a poem is a semicolon. And by the way, Updike used to say the semicolon is the valet of punctuation.
Oh, I love that.
You might say a poem is a semicolon, a living semicolon. What connects the first line to the last? And if it were not for the poem that intervenes, the first and last lines of a poem would not speak to each other. Would not speak to each other because the lines of a poem are speaking to each other, not you to them or they to you. So anyhow, I would really, really recommend this. Both these books, they're just, I have such a strong sensation of mental freedom when I read your work. As if the mind can just wander anywhere. I really love that. So anyhow, I wanted to, I often say this, that Bishop had a wonderful essay that she never finished that began, writing is an unnatural act. And, you know, all the poet's gifts are all devoted to making it seem as if he's behaving perfectly normally under the circumstances. And she says in this essay that the three qualities she loves the most in poetry are accuracy, mystery, and spontaneity. And I was wondering if there were any elements of poetry, certainly secrets matter to you, and the beginning and the end of a poem, but are there things that you look for in the work that you love?
A poem has to move me in some way, and it can be intellectually, linguistically, emotionally, in many different, when I use the word movement, see, when I say move, many people go, oh, that means emotion, but movement occurs, we are moved in life by many different layers of experience, and it has to move me on some level. But what I love is this quote of hers, which if I ever read, I forgot, that poetry is an unnatural, writing is an unnatural act, because this really speaks directly to me personally. Writing is very, very unnatural act. Most people are out living. Their bodies are, you know, they're walking and they're talking and they're working and playing and they're interacting, and writing is very unnatural because you are not living when you write. But at the same time, what a great paradox, because you're all writers, so you all know, you're all going, oh, but no, I'm most alive when I write. You know, so you are more living or less. We can't use more or less. It's just different. And this is the crux of any writer's life, is it is the essential paradox and question and torment and joy. Are you writing or living, and what's the difference, and where's the line, and how do we divide those activities, and is something, actually, Todorov did in an, I can't pronounce his first name, Desvend Todorov, who I like to read very much. He's a critic, a European critic. Wrote an essay on Rilke, which I recently read. It's an old essay, and it's a heartbreaking essay because he's quoting Rilke, and he's going on and on about Rilke, and he finally, in the end, just says, you know, the hard fact is something's lost. Something in the life is lost. But he does, you know, for Rilke's life as a living being on the planet suffered, but he gave this great gift to humanity. And what Todorov does, and what I love about him, is he says this does not only have to do with artists, this does not only have to do with writers, it has to do with every walking, living, breathing human being where you make decisions in your life. It can even be on a day-to-day basis. You know, like, do I go do this, or do I go do this activity for my, you know, do I go sit by the stream, or do I go to the party or something, you know. And he talks about how these decisions impact ordinary lives on a day-to-day basis, which I really love that he brings that in. So he just doesn't, although his main subject is Rilke, and this impossible question of what is given up when one is an artist, and writers are artists.
In that, that's all. There's just, a sort of a...
Yeah, that's here in the back.
Oh, okay. That's...
That's
just... when you did that Bishop quote, I was like, oh, yeah. I mean, I spent my whole life thinking... I mean, you know, is this unnatural? Shouldn't someone be parading outside my apartment with a cardboard placard saying, you know, insanity is taking place on the inside? You know, they really should. There'd be a point to it. And then in other moods, I go, no, the insanity is taking place out there. And I waffle back and forth. And this waffling back and forth, if you yourself experience it, it's called life. And you are going to experience this waffling back and forth for the rest of your life. And whenever you do, don't think you're unnatural or broken or different. It's life, and you're living it, and that tension is life.
Hmm. Yeah. You have that beautiful poem about your background, or the speaker's background, cul-de-sac, that ends in the address to the brother. I've never managed to balance the important and the unimportant, but maybe that is how you figure that out through your writing,
you know,
though.
We still don't.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know which side of the equation.
Hmm. So when did you first experience a kind of glimmer of conviction that you might be able to write poetry that you yourself might like?
I know when I first had the glimmer of writing poetry, but that I myself might like, that hasn't happened yet. That's why I keep writing. I keep writing in the hopes that one day I will have the glimmer of writing poetry that I myself
might like. It hasn't happened yet.
Really?
It just
I
hasn't.
I feel that there's so much enjoyment in.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. But I love hating myself too. You know, so. but the glimmer. Although I didn't recognize it until. I didn't recognize it till I was 20-something, but all right, here goes. I can't believe I'm going to do this, but here, it's when it happened. Like, how old was I, 7? We thank God for the living land, for the water that runs along the sand, for the food we eat, for the clothes we wear, for our mothers and fathers, so kind and sweet, not one can compare with a loving land such as here. That was my award-winning Thanksgiving poem in the 3rd grade.
That's terrific.
It's the only poem I've ever written that I have memorized. And the deep, utter irony of it, of course, just, but.
Yeah.
I feel that Catholicism is important to you in some major way, and I feel that a little in the poetry of Timothy Donnelly, and I mean there are quite a number of poets, contemporary poets, who are religious. I feel certainly Spencer Reese and Chris Wyman and Jane Hirschfield. I feel, but do you want to speak about the particular importance of your faith? Or
no. It's a cultural icon I grew up with, and when you grow up with a cultural icon. You can never leave it. It can never leave you. How could it ever leave me? I'm not a practicing Catholic, but it's part of the fiber of my being, and I'm sure all of you have something like that that is part of the fiber of your being. And it may be a cartoon character that you watched every Saturday morning. You know, that's I don't know, but for me, it was the baby Jesus, and I will always love him. And why anyone would want to run away from that is crazy to me. Why would you want to run away from something you spent so long, you know, like loving and obsessed with? And it comes up. It's a beautiful thing, you know. I hope that in my poems I use the Catholic figures to address issues that are larger than one religion. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
There's a sort of lightness of touch and a self-chiding quality in your poems that often makes me think of Buster Keaton. that kind of slant-wise. Yeah, the balance. The way that you kind of reveal how you're working out problems of balance, I think. So does anybody else have any questions? Elizabeth?
Can you sort of talk about the process of doing your erasures and how that feels in relation to writing the poems?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just started reading from them. I stopped. That's a long, boring story. I won't go there.
Yeah.
But they're a major part of my life. I always have to say that because people just think that this is the only one. I've made 64 books. I work on them 2 to 3 hours every morning of my life. I work more on them than I do writing poems. So it's an obsession. It's all it is. It's just an obsession. And I love every minute of it. It's... If I have that to look forward to in the morning, I can do anything. No, not at all. It's all I don't separate. I mean, it's all whatever. I do. I get lines. After I finish a book, I go and I this is new. When I did The Little White Shadow, this was not happening. When I finish a book, I go through and I take lines and use them in poems. I'll go through a book when I'm finished and I'll take the very best pages, what I think are the best pages, and I'll put them in a notebook, and if they find their way into a poem, I'm overjoyed. So now there's this interesting cross-reference between the poems that have lines from erasures and, you know, where they show up in poems.
So that's just happened in the last three, four years, and that's interesting that
so
I do
how,
that.
How quickly does the thematic thread announce itself to you? Because the one that you read to us tonight was all about poetry.
Yeah. That's why I read it to you, because there's no thematic thread in most of them. I have maybe in 64 books there are possibly seven that are continuous narrative, and the rest aren't. I am moving more towards continuous narrative in the erasures, but sometimes those books just don't present that to yourself. I can give you an example. I use exclusively 19th century children's books, or what was then called young adult fiction. I have a very special relationship with a woman named Laura Richards, who wrote the book that I was reading an erasure from, which was for children. An example would be, she wrote a book about a little boy living on the coast of Maine who dreams of running away to sea and blah, blah. And there's a Mr. Nautilus is a sea captain's name. And the boy's name is John. And there's a Mr. Endymion. There's John and Endymion, and that's all I need in a book. And the entire book is my biography of John Keats, that particular erasure, because I had a character named John, and I had a Mr. Endymion, and I just ran with it. But it has to happen, you know. I don't actually read the books. I don't read the books I erase. That would take too much time. I don't have that kind of time. No, I just erase them. But I saw Endymion and I saw John and...
Yeah. So do you do it very quickly?
Yes. Very quickly.
Too quickly. It's like scat or something, right?
Yeah. It's very quick. I mean, sometimes I'll get stuck on a page and I won't do it because I'll have to wait 2 or 3 days. But other times it's just instantaneous.
Mm-hmm. But you stay on the one book until you go on to the next.
Yeah, I do one book at a time. Mm-hmm. I do not multitask. I do not believe in multitasking. Multitasking is evil. I'm just kidding. It just doesn't suit me. I don't multitask. I write one poem at a time. I do one erasure at a time. All of that. Hmm. Yeah.
Question. I wanted to ask a question about your book of lectures and about some of the progression in the lectures, and maybe the first four essays or five are what one would call a traditional lecture, both in what you're talking about and the structure of it, right? And then it's really evolving into an experimental lecture, both in what you're talking about, but also how it may look on the page, you know, how it sounds. Some of them are a lot more funny. We're a lot more strange, mm-hmm. and are really veering in so many directions, mm-hmm. toward like the last half of the book. And I guess my question is, what kinds of things you were thinking about? What led you to experiment in so many different ways?
In the book is more or less chronologically placed. I mean, not exactly. They're mixed up, but the progression that you're noting, mm-hmm. that's real time. That's how it really happened.
Yeah, I think you said that in your intro.
Yeah, exactly how it happened. I'll tell you, the first lecture in the book is not the first, but I'll tell you exactly how it evolved. And I want you, what's important is not what I think. Translate what I'm saying into your own life. This is important. Translate it into your own life, okay? The first time I had to give a lecture, all I could care about was trying to impress people, because I was scared shitless and I wanted to do a good job and I wanted to prove something, right? That I wasn't dumb. That's what all I wanted to do, was to prove to people I wasn't dumb. And so those early themes, sentimentality, a real kind of tour de force all over the place, okay? And
after I did that, it was so boring. It was so boring to me that I said, I no longer care what people think. I'm going to make this interesting for myself. And that's the secret in your own writing life. I was just reading in the journals of Jules Renault, the French guy that Louise Bogen translated, and he has this marvelous remark, and he says, you can really begin as a writer to make progress when you stop trying to prove that you can write. And it was just, it's so succinctly put. And anyone who's been in this business for a long time knows it's absolutely true. But that said, to those of you who are very young, don't misunderstand me. There's a tiny little period in your life, and you might be in it, where you do have to try to prove yourself. Because that's how you start. And if you don't have that impetus to start, right, you might get waylaid. So the subtle thing is learning that moment in your life where you can stop. It's like when you stop imitating people, when you stop trying to prove yourself. So the lectures really show that. And by the last two lectures, I'm sorry to say it, but all I'm trying to do is have fun and write creatively. And I have no other goal. Hence, I've waited my whole life for this moment to tell you that the last lectures in the book were rejected by three magazines, the Chicago Review among them. I can't believe I'm saying this in public, because they were anti-intellectual.
Well, they're full of wonderful, wonderful, wonderful things that. So many times I stopped reading them and I thought, you know, it is necessary that I read this, discovered this, took this in. And there's one sentence I was reading today. My father just died and I just couldn't believe how this jumped out at me. People, the people we really love, where did they come from? What did we do to deserve them? It's just, has anybody else got a question for Mary?
Hi, Mary. I was wondering if you heard the news about the second apparent photograph of Emily Dickinson they found, and if so, if you've seen it.
I didn't see it. Well, there was a second one found a few years ago.
Yeah,
at West
that was not very convincing.
I believed it. What's the new one?
Yeah.
Kate Bacon or something? Okay. So she's like 19, 20? What?
I think it's later.
I didn't see it. Was it in today's New York Times?
I think yesterday's.
Ah.
It's been around for about a week, actually.
We get it in Vermont about 3 weeks after it's published here, so. No. What I adore Emily Dickinson. Anyone
right.
who knows me knows how much I adore her. I don't need any more photographs of her. I don't even need the one, but I'm so thankful for it. And if there's another, it could only fill me with joy. I have no opinion, having not read the article, as to whether or not I think it's real or not, but you need to know I'm an extremely gullible person, and I believe that the one found a few years ago in California, I totally believed it. I believe everything that anyone says to me or shows me. I just believe it. Why not?
Anybody else here have a question or want to say something?
It's a very simple one. Japanese blood god.
Yeah.
I googled it. I couldn't figure it out.
The poem. The title.
What Japanese blood? Yeah, the title.
Oh, I just made that up. Japanese blood god. I don't remember where the. I have some titles I remember where they came from. I'm sorry. I have.
I have no idea where that title came from. I just don't remember.
I love those moments.
Japanese blood god.
Pachinko. Oh. The word enters the bloodstream in me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Japanese blood god. I don't remember. Yeah, pachinko comes from the fact that my father was in, he fought in the Pacific in the Second World War, and he was stationed in Japan afterwards, and a pachinko machine is a Japanese, what do you, in bars you play, like,
pinball.
Yeah. It's Japanese, pachinko's Japanese pinball, and he brought home for his family a Japanese pachinko machine. So I grew up with a pachinko machine in the basement. So that's how I knew that word. So see, some of the things I can trace, that one, clueless, don't remember. But thank you for your kind words.
But in the poem, it has the weight of a word like nothing. Yeah. It's a major word. In the
pachinko.
Poem.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Well, thanks a million.
Yeah, one last. Oh, no.
Want to unerase or re-erase?
Well, I do that all the time. I edit erasure books. After I've erased a book, after it's done, I totally go back and revise it. So if I have 6 words on a page, it gets down to 3 or 4. No, you can edit. There's revision in erasure. Well, all you have to do is just try it once and you get it. It's like you do a book and then I go through the whole thing again and I'm erasing like mad. The erasures, because
it's always in the direction of further erasure.
Absolutely. Well, it's always it's in that further direction of whatever further direction we go to when we revise poems.
But you always leave the order the way it is.
Well, I mean, I've got 6 words on a page and I'm going down to 3, but they're going to be sequential. Yeah, you know, you can just be too wordy all the time, and you can be too wordy in erasing too. And you go, oh, I didn't need that word, you know, except you might need it for sound. And if you need it for sound, you have to keep it. Sound in poetry is the reason we keep unnecessary words. And if it's not for sound, they shouldn't be there. But for sound, that's a whole different thing. Then legitimately you can waste words for sound. But if it's not for sound, get rid of them. So I made.
So I hope I'll be forgiven for saying that I am choosing poems now for Andrew Sullivan's really smart and very popular blog. So From the New Yorker to the Dish, that's where I'm choosing poems. And I have 3 a week. And Mary's Standing Furthest, which is on your program, was the first one. And so it's a 20th century poem, a 21st century poem, and a pre-20th century poem each week. And so yours was with a D.H. Lawrence poem and a Byron, so we'll go no more a roving. And it's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And next week we have a poem by Mary Evans. Does anybody know who she is? She was an important black poet in the 60s. And a wonderful poem by Michael Drayton. And, you know, Josh Beckman was last week, and Ann Porter. So it's an interesting mix. And Mary was my inaugural poet, and Jean Valentine was in it too, so... Anyway, let's have a little wine and buy some books and get Mary to sign them, okay? Thanks very much.